A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
So I got back from my deployment on February 2018, so a couple of months later. I was getting these really, really bad recurring headaches. And really, it just became that, yeah, mate, we can give you something, but just because you're in the army, it's very easy for us to get you a CAT scan. And I guess the first time I ever found out something might not be right was it was actually the radiologist rang me, basically like, hey, mate, I can't tell you anything because I'm not your doctor, but you need to go and see your doctor straight away. I've left an email.
Sir, what if the writer is attempting to create a story where nothing much happens, where people don't change? More reflection of the real world.
Nothing happens in the world? Are you out of your fucking mind?
Welcome to A Theory of Mind, a podcast about brains, minds, and the psyche from me, author and biographer Ben McKelvey. Each week, I sit down with someone about the lived-in experience of change, and this week, my guest is Matt Willie Williams, AM, a 25-year-old Adelaide man who's already lived more lives than most. By the age of 22, Willie had already trained as a rifleman, deployed to Afghanistan as a crew commander, and had also discovered an inoperable growth in his brain, something that would be with him for the rest of his life. In the 3 years since that discovery, Willie has become an inspirational figure, refusing to simply be a passenger in the cruel vehicle he's found himself in. Instead, he's becoming a fundraising machine, with his efforts putting tens of thousands of dollars towards brain cancer research. Furthermore, Willie has given himself purpose and passion in the service of others. He's found a bright light in a dark time and was recently recognised with the Order of Australia Medal. I really enjoyed talking to Willie about service and hope after spending a little time talking also about his time in Afghanistan. At the end of our conversation, Willie details where you can find him and how you can contribute, but I thought I'd put it here at the top of the show also. On Facebook and Instagram, Willie is willie.beating.cancer, and on both pages there are donation links to the Charlie Teo Foundation. If you want to stay in touch with the show, you can do so at my Instagram, which is at Benny Merck, BennyMck, and without further ado, Matt Willie Williams.
Look, it's a weird one with me getting in the military because I didn't have a family that really served. I had a couple of, you know, uncles and whatever that were reserves, but nothing really direct family that had a big military career. So I don't really know where the passion first sort of came from to join the army. But from ever since I can remember, it's been there wanting to join, and I think mum and dad probably thought it was a bit of a phase. And then, you know, next thing, I'm in year 12 and I'm signing up and then leaving school to go. And I think it became awfully real for them. But look, the passion has always been, you know, the same as anyone will say. You know, there's always that bit of wanting to serve and, you know, it's a good job and all that. But I think for a lot of people, joining the army is just something they couldn't really put their finger on why they're doing it. It's just something they feel like they need to do.
What were the strong associations that you had with the army before you actually joined? The things that you saw yourself doing that was attractive to you?
Yeah. Look, I just wanted to like have a job where I was out with the boys working. You know, you always think, you know, the army's always different to what you imagine, I guess. But, you know, I grew up, I was sort of, you know, that year 9 to 12 bracket. You know, when the heaviest fighting in Afghan was going on. Like I joined the army in 2014. So, you know, in those, you know, 2010 to 14, when I was, you know, at that age of thinking of joining, like really seriously thinking of joining, you know, there was a lot of stuff coming back from Afghanistan of not only, you know, tragically guys being killed, but also, you know, footage of, you know, guys on the ground doing the job on the tools. And I think that's what I really envisioned myself doing, and that's all I wanted to do. And I guess that was the one way of doing it. There's no other way of doing that job than joining up.
So there was an attraction to what was actually being done on the battlefield. It wasn't something else. It wasn't like a stable job. I mean, you know, these would have been things that you would have been thinking about as well, you know, the salary and stuff like that. But you saw yourself on the ground in Afghanistan because you had seen that imagery when you were at that sort of at that really fertile age, sort of around year 9 and 10.
That's all it was. And it always has been that too, you know. And it's always just been that attraction to the battlefield. Like I'm an absolute sack of a barrack soldier, like terrible. But you know, it's always been about doing the field to be on the battlefield. Now a lot of modern soldiers don't get that opportunity, but it's always been that's where the job ends. That's the pointy bit of the job, and that's always been the attraction and still is the attraction. If Australia rolled back on full scale into a war and they needed guys on that battlefield, I'd be the first one in the line re-signing back up.
Tell me about your deployment. I understand you had one Afghan deployment, is that correct?
Yeah, one Afghan deployment on Operation High Road in 17.
Tell me about it and tell me, you know, the things that, the expectations that were met and also the things that were super surprising for you. Did you have a lot of interactions with Afghans? Were you working with, mentoring task force or something like that?
Yeah, so we were on the FPE, so the force protection element. So it was a very different deployment to the early day Afghan MTFs, MRTFs, ATF trips. And I think in some ways as an infantryman, as a person, incredibly awesome experience and a growing experience. As an infantryman, it was probably some parts very below our job, of the kill and capture the enemy phase wasn't there. We were there as force protection for, VIPs and for the mentoring of Afghan soldiers. But in that of the Australian regular forces, that is the highest, sort of deployment we had at the time. It wasn't like one of the other RARs was on a gunfighter mission down south. It wasn't. We were of the regular army. We were it. The tip of the spear, so to speak. So it was sort of like, well, this is the best we're going to get. And I guess what separates it from a lot is, there was so many moving parts and elements that we had exposure to from, moving around the city in Kabul, interacting with the local police and security forces and a lot of other nations, all the way through to, on the ground, task group training, proving a route before someone else drove down it, whatever. But as far as warfighter stuff, it just didn't really happen for us.
So you were there in 2017. By 2017, the war is, the war is phase changing in that it's concluded that the Taliban are going to be given a large part of the country. And a lot of the things that Australia tried to do in Uruzgan, they just weren't going to happen because we were such a small part of a larger picture. Was that something that you thought about much over there? Was that something that you guys talked about at all?
Yeah, it became something very, very relevant for us over there was when ground one in Uruzgan by the Australian and coalition forces was starting to be taken back and lost to the Taliban or, other terrorist organisations. Now, myself, that was my first deployment, but, of course, a lot of the section commanders at the time were, down south in Afghan, fighting, really fighting the war that was by 2017 and current being lost. And it became a bit of a weird feeling for a lot of the guys I know when it was like, such and such died to take that land and now we're handing it all back. We should be doing anything we can to hold it. Were these lives lost worth it if in, 5 years, 10 years, we're just handing it all back? And that overall picture, I know, it's changed a lot from, taking the fight to them to training people to take the fight with them. But there was an element of, why aren't we rolling out the door alongside the guys we're training?
You actually just transitioned out of the army, literally, what was it, a couple of days ago?
Yeah, so today's Friday and my last day was Tuesday, so a couple of days.
So we, you know, we're going to get to the big meaty story in between. But how did you feel about knowing that you were going to be a civilian? You knowing that you were going to be defined in a different way. It's something that a lot of people have had a lot of issues with. But you know, how did you feel?
It was a weird, like a completely weird feeling of like, you know, that I don't. It's weird that I just can't like walk back on the base. You know, I've served at 7RA at RAF Edinburgh for so long. You know, I even lived there for a couple of years when I lived on the barracks. It's been such a big part of my life that it was something I really took for granted, just being in the army, seeing the boys every day, and everything in between. And now there's that sort of loss of not only, you know, people talk a lot about loss of identity, but I think it's just loss of such a big part too. You know, it was something I did for 8 or 9 hours every day of my life. And especially, you know, having guys, when I was a section commander, it, you know, became a 24-hour job where, you know, guys be hitting me up, you know, text me on any day, like, hey, who do I put leave in through or just whatever. And now there's a loss of, you know, a lot of work. You know, that might sound brilliant to some people, but it's something that's weird. It's like, oh shit, what do I do now? How do I fill in my day?
Well, let's talk about the chunk in between, you know, in between Afghan and here. So you have, you know, had some medical issues and maladies. Can you tell me about when you first had an understanding of what was happening to you?
Yeah, so it was so I got back from my deployment on September 2017. And then, you know, there's some courses and whatever in between that. But then February 2018, so a couple of months later, I was getting these really, really bad recurring headaches and couldn't shake them without, you know, taking a fair chunk of codeine. But it was in that same week of February 18 that codeine became a prescription drug only, and the fear of then getting drug tested and getting booted came very alive. So my solution, you know, go down to the med centre, cop shit off the lads for going down there as you do, especially if it's a pack march Friday. Go down there and then, you know, find out what the hell's going on, see if I can get a prescription for some drugs. And really it just became that, yeah, mate, we can give you something, but just because you're in the army, it's very easy for us to get you a CAT scan, so we'll give you a scan. And I guess the first time I ever found out something might not be right was it was actually the radiologist rang me on my drive back to work after the CAT scan. Basically like, hey, mate, I can't tell you anything because I'm not your doctor, but you need to go and see your doctor straight away. I've left an email with him. And then rocking straight back up to the med center again and having pretty much getting handed a referral to go and get an MRI because they'd found like a shady spot in my brain.
Can you tell me about that staggered experience of getting the phone call and saying, okay, mate, you need to talk to your doctor after getting a CAT scan in the head? I can only imagine the panic that would have been coursing through my veins, and especially afterwards where he's like, okay, we've seen a shadow. What was your mind state? You know, how are you feeling?
My mind wasn't even like considering it could be the extent of what it is. I was thinking more, there's fucking whatever, like, you know, it's a cyst or it's a fuck up in the X-ray or what. Like, I didn't even think it was, you know, that had potential to be what it was. So I guess it wasn't really panic. It was more of like, oh, for God's sake, I have to, you know, drive back to work, get on the base, and then drive back out to someone to get a bloody MRI. Like, for God's sake.
And then you got your fMRI. And at that point, did you get a solid diagnosis?
Well, no, not even then. So I had the MRI and then a referral, an emergency referral to see a neurosurgeon. And that surgeon basically was like, mate, look, we can see it pretty well. This is here. He showed me the large thing. And I was incredibly surprised by how bloody big it was. I thought, you know, it's like when you break your arm, you get an X-ray or a CAT scan. It's like, oh, here's the break. And it's this hairline fucking fracture you can barely see. You know, I'm guessing you've seen the scans I've put on Instagram that it pops up and it's a 40 millimeter shadow in my brain. You know, they do a side MRI and a top down. So it's, you know, it's 40 millimetres across and 38 millimetres deep. And I'm like, holy shit, like that's big. Like that, you know, that's bigger than a golf ball big in my fucking head. And from there it was, look, mate, we can see it. We can look at the density and the sort of line it up with what we think it could be. But we need to cut you open and take a biopsy of what this is to actually find out, you know, what it actually is in your head.
And so they were doing that almost immediately. So you got your CAT scan on your Friday, and I can imagine it would have been, you know, within a week that they were like, okay, we want to cut your head open.
Oh, well within. All happened within, like, you know, the next week at work. Yeah. Anyway, next thing I'm on my first ever surgery. I'm on a bloody hospital bench, you know, going into a neurosurgery, you know, cutting open, drilling through my skull to take a bit of the tumour. The biggest thing I didn't understand in this was that I woke up out of the surgery, and any surgery is traumatic on the body, and I'd say probably especially on your brain. It doesn't matter how minor or major it is, because this is a pretty minor brain surgery, but a brain surgery is still it's pretty traumatic on the head. You know, you wake up not feeling too great. I mean, poking your bloody brain after all. But probably the biggest thing I didn't understand out of this was I was expecting to get the pathology results of the tumour almost right away, like a blood test. What I didn't understand when I woke up was that the sample they'd taken has to go to a lab and get tested and whatever, and it can take 6 to 8 weeks to get the result back. So I'm hanging in absolute limbo of, like, well, shit, you know, is this something that could kill me in a week, or is completely benign and, you know, don't worry about it?
So that's what they told you, that they were testing, you know, whether it was malignant, whether it was benign, whether it was aggressive, you know, whether it was cancerous.
Yeah, they more just need to figure out what exactly it is. Like, what is the designation of this tumour? What type is it? Is it growing? You know, is it, what stage cancer is it? Whatever. And I thought I'd know all this information straight away, because having bad news is easier than hanging in limbo. And probably the biggest breakdown I had in this was, say, 7 weeks from there, over a hard 7 weeks, because I don't know what's going on. I get a call up, like, the day before I was meant to go to another appointment. Hey, mate, yeah, we're cancelling your appointment. Someone's forgotten to do one of the tests. It's going to be another 2 weeks. And me just completely cracking the shits and sort of losing my mind, because I'm like, I've just waited 7 weeks to, you know, in limbo trying to get these results. That's just a terrible feeling. And I was mentally prepared to get them, you know, tomorrow. And now someone somewhere has had a fuck up, and it's going to be another couple of weeks.
How did you manage those weeks? How did you manage your mental state? How did you manage your anxiety?
Look, those first weeks, not well. not well at all. There's a lot of drinking, a lot of going out, a lot of, you know, casual sex, a lot of fucking weird shit.
Did you tell people?
Yeah, I told everyone. I was very open about it all in the beginning, and I think that was probably the biggest blessing I've ever done, is being particularly open about it. But, like, those weeks are pretty much just a blur of stress in my head. Like, you know, I couldn't tell you day to day, but, you know, very, very unproductive weeks of my life, because I didn't know whether – I was dying in a day or dying in, you know, normal time in 70 years, but I just had no idea.
Yeah. And, you know, outside of, you know, drinking, casual sex, you know, doing all the, like, compressing the 20s into you know, just a few weeks, did your mindset change at all? Were there any feelings of grace? Were there any feelings of, did anything good come out of that period or not?
Look, I think you could probably pull good parts out of it, being of, like, you know, if I ever went down that path again, you know, I'd be able to recognise issues, like, oh, shit, I'm not feeling well. But, you know, in those initial weeks, not much good comes of, you know, a mental state that sort of rough. Like, I just had no drive to do anything but drink and fuck around. So I guess the good thing that came out of it was, I guess, hitting a bit of rock bottom and then, you know, re-piecing everything back together once the diagnosis came. But at the same time, you know, it was an incredibly hard time.
Tell me about when that diagnosis came. Tell me, tell me everything you remember about that moment.
Yeah, so it came on March 9th. And I remember that because that was, it was one day before my birthday, which is March 10th. And I remember all I got was, instead of seeing the neurosurgeon, I got like a text for an appointment to go to see an oncologist. And I didn't even know what the hell an oncologist was until I Googled it. And it turns out, you know, cancer clinic, cancer doctor. Anyway, ended up walking in, seeing this oncologist, getting the diagnosis of the glioma tumor in my brain. And just that sinking feeling, like the same sort of feeling as if you broke up with your long-term partner. Where you're just like, what? Like, it's just an unbelievable thing. But, you know, it was at least at that point I had something solid, like a solid diagnosis. You know, I knew what it was. But then, of course, you know, that's when they start looking at treatment options and everything from there.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Now, you, like every good soldier, when you're presented with a problem, then I find that soldiers are very sort of process driven. You know, they sort of figure out what the problem is, they sort of address it, and they say, okay, what we have to do now is X, Y, and Z. When you have, you know, a medical malady like you were presented with, things are sort of out of your hands to a certain extent. So how did you empower yourself? How did you say, okay, I'm going to be part of the process, this is what I'm going to do for myself?
Yeah, well, that's a really good question, because it's a really hard process, and you've picked up that, you know, it's a lot of out of your hands. And I think that's the Army's done a lot for me in mental resilience, you know, to deal with this, but it's also done a lot that doesn't help, because, you know, everything follows a bouncing ball process in the military, and this doesn't. So my mind went, as soon as I had diagnosis, I'm like, well, why the fuck am I not on a surgery table tomorrow and we're cutting this out? Why am I not starting chemo tomorrow? Why am I not, like, what is the next step? What are we doing? What are we doing? Not, yeah, we're going to watch and wait it and see what happens. That's not what you do. You know, at no point in the military do you, you know, watch and wait something that's going to kill you without, you know, taking some sort of decisive action at all. You know, it's just against every part of my body. When it was really, no, we need to take a step back and, you know, watch and wait and see in the process. And so much of it is out of your control. So much. There's no part of it other than your mental state that's within your control. It's the same part as people say, you know, you fight cancer. You don't fight cancer. You fight your mental health. Your body will do what it does no matter what. You don't have, other than, you know, little things, but you don't have that much control over what the tumor does at all. Your battle, the fighting cancer, is against your own mind.
Did you identify that straight away, that was the part that you were in control of?
I think I didn't identify it straight away. I think it was identified my oncologist. I was seeing him, you know, a couple of times a week, if not more. And I think he noticed a change in my personality that he'd met me from the first time. And then I got a referral to a psychologist from there. And then the psychologist really brought up that's, you know, he said, you talk about like process so much of, you know, that you feel like you're being left behind because nothing's happening. He said, you need to find something that is controllable for you and that gives a purpose. You know, at this point I was off work on sick leave, and my purpose of being in the military was sort of diminishing. You know, what becomes the purpose of someone with an illness like this? Well, you need to refine it, refine what you can control and go from there. And I sort of found in those, you know, initial months that I can't control anything around my tumor, but I can control, I guess, treatment options available in the future for tumors and cancers through, you know, fundraising or whatever for research into these.
Well, it's a really interesting way of doing it because, you know, as you said, when you're in the military, things are process oriented and they're not about you, you know? Like there's not a lot of time that's spent making sure that Willow feels all right, you know? You're doing something else. There's a sort of larger question, but, you know, the problem that you'd been presented with was all about you, and all of these people were going to be looking inward about your health and, you know, what we were going to do next for you. But it's really interesting that you've, you know, with this fundraising piece, that you've actually managed to go external again, be like, okay, how can we help people who are in the situation that I'm in, and using me as an example for that? When did you identify that that's what you were going to do?
Look, I couldn't put my finger exactly on, you know, when it became that, but I think it definitely became out of appointment with a psychiatrist being like, Willie, you're not a bucket list person. You're a purpose driven, and you need a purpose to get up in the morning, not an activity to do through the day, and like a long-term purpose. And I think from there it became, well, what am I able to do and that purpose be meaningful? It'll be contributing to something greater than myself. And that's, you know, the military is a fantastic purpose because, of course, you're contributing something. You're a very small cog in a very large machine. You're contributing to something bigger than yourself. And that's where I found, I guess, the fundraising and exposure for cancer research, in particular brain cancer research, I was a very small cog in a very large machine. But it made a real difference to people's lives, and a difference beyond the life of my own as well. So I couldn't tell you when I put my finger on that, because originally my tire flip fundraiser, the first one, all I wanted to do was, you know, beach PT session with my platoon down and flip a tire for a couple of Ks and raise, well, the initial GoFundMe was for $500. That's all I wanted to do. Mm. And then, you know, people got on board and it blew up, you know, very large. But that purpose was always the same. It wasn't ever a figure or a event. It was always to have, you know, it's like the most selfish yet non-selfish thing you could do. I'm getting so much out of it in the way of, you know, health for me. You know, I always tell people I get the most out of these events. Because it really makes me feel like I'm having a difference, and that helps my physical and mental health so much. It just became a good thing, and I started seeing a lot of changes and, you know, myself get particularly more healthy, not physically because I was on chemo, but in my own brain, that I'd refound, you know, a reason for doing stuff.
Are you a mindful type of person? Are you someone who, you know, meditates and who takes time to just sort of put your feet in the ocean and stuff like that? Or how are you dealing with the, you know, the real bottom down moments of chemo?
Yeah, I wish I was more mindful, and I wish I was more spiritual as well, but I'm not like any of it, because I think it would be a lot easier process. The bottom down moments for me was hanging on, hanging on for the grass is greener sort of attitude of, well, this finishes, I've got, you know, two more treatments left or this or that. And there was a lot of hanging on and looking for greener pastures. But I'm definitely not, I think a lot of people over credit me with the ability to overcome and resilience during those times. That haven't seen how low the lows were, particularly, say, during the chemotherapy. And the chemo really took me away from doing a lot of the stuff that I use as, I guess, a substitute for traditional meditation, you know, stuff like the gym and going for a run or a walk or, you know, even, you know, distracting yourself going to work. In the first months, yes, that was, doable. And something, you know, I could go for a walk or do this or do that. But in those last, because I did 13 months of chemo, in the last, say, I don't know, 7 months of it, maybe longer, that became unachievable. I couldn't go to and I have a home gym at home, but I couldn't walk from my bed to the couch. I couldn't make it. I had to have a chair halfway and I had to have my parents support me walking because my body had become that weak. You know, there's no way I'm going to be able to even lift a weight. So it became, you know, that statutory sort of shit life rolling between the two. But it was always that And I remember saying to my mum when she was helping me in and out of chemo, you know, wards and whatever, that I might be hopeless, but I'm not helpless. That yes, I'm fucking hopeless. Like my body's fucking useless at the moment, but I'm not helpless. It's not that I can't still be helped to do something, to achieve something, to do, you know, to get up. And that became just, you know, identifying the little bits and identifying an end. And that got hard when the end, you know, where I thought the end was kept getting pushed. That, you know, I did 3 months of chemo and that was initially it. It was 3 months. And then it got pushed to six. And then at 6 month mark when I thought I was done, it got pushed to nine. And then at nine it got pushed to 12, 13. You know, that's very, very fucking draining. And, you know, those last months were just hanging on.
Now, with the sort of medical ebb and flow, you know, you'd be getting diagnoses, you'd be getting little bits of information, you know, you'd get blood tests, you get, you know, head scans and all that sort of stuff. You know, and it's sort of a little bit forward, a little bit back, all that sort of stuff. Were you attentive to what was happening every single day as though it was like a footy season or something like that? Or were you like, that part is out of my hands, I'll worry about it when we get to thresholds?
I think I'd like to think I was very involved in my treatment, especially in the beginning. But there was parts that I'm like, this is your job, doc. Just let me know what I need to do and give me the drugs or do this. You know, there was a little bit of like, yeah, tracking, but I don't have the capacity to, you know, think about that at the moment, mate. Just let me know where to be, what to do and what to swallow or have stick to my arm. But I'd like to be involved as much as I could, and I think it was hard not to be involved that much with what was going on, of the amount of information coming down. And I'd like to think that I've done a fair bit of my own research into, you know, my particular illness, but as well as, you know, seeing three neurosurgeons at once, you know, through other appointments, that I have a pretty vast understanding, particularly of well, a lot of how these cancers work and how mine particularly works.
The cancer that was in your head was, you know, pretty big. Like you said, it was larger than a golf ball. What was the part of the brain that it was affecting? And could you recognise that there were, you know, symptoms outside of pain? Were there any psychological issues? Were there any physiological issues? Was your brain being affected in another way?
So this is probably the biggest thing that stumped the doctors so far, is I've got no neurocognitive issues, like zero. And this is something that stumps them to a degree, because they say, look, if it was half the size, we could believe you don't have any, but at the size of yours, you should have some, and I've got none. They're probably something I forgot in the previous conversation about my initial diagnosis of the headaches. The headaches ended up being completely unrelated. I ended up seeing the neurosurgeon. He was like, mate, this won't show as a headache. Like, is there anything else going on? Ended up getting a bloody referral to see a physio to do some dry needling on one of my shoulders that was a bit bung from work. And that was causing the headache, was some tension in my traps, and that was it. So the headaches were not related, but, you know, through that unrelated product, then I got, you know, diagnosed with this. Whether it saved my life or whatever, you know, whether you'd want to know or not is sort of out of the question, because I do know.
You had no other symptoms. But there was nothing else outside of these headaches that gave you any inkling that there was an issue going on. You didn't have balance problems. There was nothing.
Nothing at all. And, you know, still to this day, I like to think I don't have any. You know, sometimes I will get something, you know, I'll get pins and needles in my hand and think, oh, fuck. But then it goes. Same as I have, you know, sometimes I'll be standing there and be a little bit off balance. Oh, fuck. And catch myself. But I don't think it's anything more than, I think a lot of people have little things like that. You know, where your brain switches off for a sec. But, you know, as far as neurocognitive issues that myself or my surgeons have seen, I've got nothing. Which can make it a little bit harder, because, you know, I often talk that during chemo I felt like a cancer patient. You know, my prognosis fit how I was feeling. Yep, I feel like a cancer patient. I feel like I'm dying. Probably easy to come to terms with it. Both before and after those treatments, particularly now that I'm feeling so well, it's hard to believe it. I feel like I'm a bit of a fucking fraud, because it doesn't ring true. It's like, what do you mean I'm this sick but feel this good? Like, how can I have such a fucking absolute horrific illness, a terrible prognosis, but I feel completely fine. And I'm in the gym every day and I'm out drinking beers with the lads and I'm, you know, doing this and that. How can these, it doesn't add up, if that makes sense, and that can be a hard thing to get your head around.
Yeah, but do you have the capacity to sort of go back and think about when you were sick and also think about when you were diagnosed and the panic and all that sort of stuff and say, okay, I won't feel this, survivor's remorse or whatever it is. You know, I won't feel bad about feeling good. I'll just be in the moment and feel good. Are you capable of doing that?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what I have to do. I have to look back and think, fuck, yeah, it was that bad. And I have to look back and be real with it too. You know, and you look back at something and you think, oh, that wasn't as bad as it was. And it's like a school camp. You're on a school camp and it's shit, but you get home a week later, yeah, that was really good. It can be easy to look back at the good times and things like that. But I need to be real and look back and think, hang on, no. I lost 13 months of chemo, but, you know, look at the, I'd say, you know, for the first 3-4 months after it, I felt, you know, terrible as well. So let's go 16, 17 months. I lost 17 months of my life sick when I was 22 to 23 and a half. That's not a fucking good thing. I must have been fucking crook because I was like, well, you know, I can get up out of bed with a pretty bad hangover and, you know, do something productive. But if I'm stuck in bed for a week, unable to watch TV because my mind can't deal with the distraction because it's too overwhelming for my senses, I must have been very fucking ill.
You were saying that, you know, mindfulness is not something, it's something that you sort of wish you had had more of. But, you know, like I follow you on Instagram and the battle against the lawn, you know, gardening is a very zen thing to do. What you're trying to create is sort of, you know, a perfect carpet of green. You know, this is a very zen goal to try and attend. Do you think that's something that's going on in your psyche?
No, I think it could be, but I think it's more just it's a really fun interaction between myself and, you know, my friends and followers. It's just something that, you know, people are, the interaction's fucking funny as, because I'm having all these people from all around the world send me photos of their lawn and take the piss out of mine and doing all this stuff. It's probably a distraction to some degree, but at the same point, it's a really, lighthearted thing. But it's funny because I've had people as well hit me up and be like, the reason I love it, Willie, is you're using, you know, you're on social media and your primary fucking thing at the moment is trying to grow your lawn. And they said it's such a refreshing, almost fresh breath of air from social media at the moment, because most of social media is someone trying to sell you something or a fucking election or this fucking coronavirus. It's a fresh relief just to look on and some dickhead's out in his front yard shooting his lawn like a gun with the fucking water. So it's one of those things that just sort of grew. It's just a bog piss take.
So tell me about where you are at the moment. You know, you've been fundraising. You've congratulations been awarded the Order of Australia. What are your goals? What are your sort of plans? Where's your life at the moment?
Yeah, so right now, I'm sort of getting used to that civvy life. Getting used to not shaving every day and actually being able to do my own thing. Right now, it was very hard to make a lot of plans and stuff around the virus that's cruising, apparently. But I think I'm really waiting on the next scans. The next scans, I don't have the exact dates on me, but it's like early or mid-February is my three-monthly interval scan. And that's always, you know, a bit of a foot up the arse of, yep, okay, this is happening. This is real. You know, you better live life for the next 3 months. It's a fantastic reminder every 3 months to keep living your life, because it's, you know, it's bound to end at some point. But, you know, my long-term goal really is to do a lot of traveling and media stuff. So, you know, I run a small vlog on my YouTube, and really what my primary goal is, and this is, you know, my Instagram bio, the first line is redefining terminal illness. And more what I want to do is follow my adventures being, you know, however great or small with this sort of around the world and, you know, domestically and whatever, as some sort of like, one, a bit of a diary for myself, B, but two, I guess, proof that your life moves forward from here. You know, I think even if you heard on a movie, if the fucking bad villain guy got a brain tumor, you'd be like, yep, well, he's dead. That's no living on from there. But I'd like, you know, to really show that, you know, well, it does go on. And, you know, that'll outlive myself as well. So that's the main thing is, you know, getting into traveling and a lot of media stuff there. That's the, you know, short to long-term goal. The short term's really getting the scan over and done with, you know, sorting out the final bits of civilian life. You know, like today I'm getting a, trying to get ambulance cover today after this, like little things like that. But then, you know, there'll always be an element of the fundraising and whatever linked in with anything I do.
My last question for you is, you know, you were saying that you got the scan coming up and, you know, it's 3 months and, you know, you sort of got to remember to live. What does it mean to you to remember to live? What are the moments where you're like, okay, yes, this is living, this is me doing it?
I think the best moments to remember are the moments you didn't realize that you were in the moment when you were, when you almost wake up from it, you're like, oh shit, I had, you know, I was living in the moment then with no outside distraction at all. And I think that's the things that I live for, are those moments where you're that, you know, focused and in depth on a conversation or an activity or whatever, that you were so just living in the moment. And those moments are so rare and so important to look back on and remember. But also more importantly, to put yourself in situations where they can be created, because you don't have those moments sitting in a lounge room having a beer, but you do have them with your best friends out doing something. Or, you know, overcoming a problem or whatever. So I think, you know, sort of seeking those, you know, once a year moments where you're truly living in that moment, that's something that really, really drives me and pushes me forward. And that's what I really sort of live for, I guess.
I'm going to let you go, but if you could just, you know, tell us what your social handles are so people can find you, that'd be great.
Yeah, so across all my socials is Willie Beating Cancer. My primary socials are Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook. But the best way to reach out to me is through my Instagram. I reply to all messages and comments, whatever. I would really love to hear from people, and I do really appreciate all the support. And you know, I appreciate yourself having me on to talk a bit of shit on your podcast as well.
Oh, mate, it's been such a pleasure. It's been great talking to you, and we wish you the best, and we'll check in again and see what's going on in a few months' time.
Absolutely, mate. I look forward to it.
That was Matt Willie Williams, an inspiring bloke who I learned a lot from. That's it for this week's episode of A Theory of Mind. We have another interview coming next Wednesday, but before then, look out for a bonus podcast, something a little bit different. I'm Ben McKelvey, and until then, as always, follow your bliss.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.